Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, working to build a more effective, compassionate, and just healthcare system. On the web at chcf.org/health-equity.
From KVPR, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, civil rights activist Dolores Huerta tells us about a new peace and justice center that will bear her name. And later, we'll introduce you to a popular Lao chicken and rice food truck parked in the small community of Goshen. But first, a year ago this Saturday, the Creek Fire broke out in the Sierra Nevada in eastern Fresno County. On this anniversary, we're launching a new limited-run podcast about one of the most dramatic moments in that first weekend, the late-night evacuations of campers from Mammoth Pool Reservoir. Here's the first episode, brought to you by KVPR's Carrie Klein.
"911, state emergency."
How do you respond under pressure?
"We're at Wagner's campground, and it looks like there's a fire south by where the lake is."
When you find yourself in an unimaginable situation.
Which lake are you at, sir?
Mammoth Pool Lake.
Do you stay calm?
Do you see flames from where you are right now?
In every direction, yes.
Focused?
Approximately how many people are down there, approximately?
I want to say 150 to 200 people. But we have burn victims, and we have a girl that's severely burned.
When does that tough veneer start to give way?
We have people running to the lake, like on foot, running to the lake as fast as they can because there's fire everywhere.
To fear.
There's fire on both sides of the truck. We're driving through the fire.
And panic.
Get in!
And what do you do when there's only one way to survive?
Then you have to get out and you have to run to the lake.
Just get in the water, and that's the best you're going to be able to do, okay?
But let's back up 24 hours. Before the Creek Fire created chaos, before it created panic and gridlock, before parents were separated from their kids, before drivers were forced to ram through smoldering trees and hikers literally outran the flames, hundreds of people were just camping at Mammoth Pool Reservoir over Labor Day weekend 2020, like Carla Carcamo.
"We have a family tradition."
For Carla, the long weekend meant one thing, huge family party, like really huge.
"Most of it is my family and family that it's invited family. And those family friends have invited friends of theirs. I'm telling you, we have over 200 people.
Cousins, aunts and uncles, babies, grandparents, coworkers, with tents, RVs, lights, music, beer, and food. So much food.
And to even tell you, we had a griddle that we use because we have pupusa night. We're Salvadorian."
Most of Carla's family lives near Los Angeles. She's in Northridge. It takes about 6 hours to get to Mammoth Pool, but they keep coming back year after year after year.
"Yeah, my family has been going there every year for the past 17 plus years."
The reservoir sneaks along the San Joaquin River at the border of Madera and Fresno counties, nestled in the foothills at an elevation of about 3,000 feet.
"Being there, let me tell you, it's like a little piece of paradise."
Cell service is patchy here, and there's only one long winding highway in and out. Drive uphill from the lake about 2 miles on a narrow dirt road, and you'll reach the massive campground where Carla's family was staying. Like so many Sierra Nevada lakes, Mammoth Pool sparkles. Bright blue water, hills covered in a thick forest of black oaks and ponderosa pines. It's straight out of a postcard. Or at least it was, before a blazing inferno reduced it to a barren moonscape. In that first weekend, the Creek Fire was one of the fastest moving, most intense wildfires in California history. And yet, thanks to the National Guard and to normal, everyday people not thinking twice about being heroes, everyone camping that weekend survived. This is the story of how 242 people and 16 dogs escaped Mammoth Pool Reservoir. The lake's isolation and natural beauty didn't just attract Carla's family. Alex Tedamonte and her husband Raul Reyes were regulars too.
It's beautiful.
Just the smell, I mean, everything.
Yeah, just the smell of all the pine trees and stuff. And the trees are so big, it's really cool.
They're part of an off-roading club that comes to the lake every year to play with big toys. Trucks, quads, jet skis. Rolando Rosales and his family belong to the club too.
Well, I like everything. I like the lake, I like the trails. We also used to go hiking from the campsite to the lake and then come back on the cars, the wives.
He was here that weekend with his wife, their two kids, and their niece and nephew. By Friday, these three families, whom we'll follow throughout the series, were settled in and ready to celebrate. They were all staying at Mammoth Pool Campground, also known as Wagner's Campground, right by Wagner's store. They spent the day hiking, visiting waterfalls, and riding ATVs. Here's Rolando's wife, Vicky Castro.
Friday, everybody went down to the lake. Everybody who wanted to go to the lake, take their jet skis. And we were in the little river that passes through Wagner Camp with the kids and everything. So it was just like normal camping.
Dinner that night would seem normal too. Carne asada, ribs, the usual. But unbeknownst to all of them, around 6:45 p.m., in a canyon far to the southeast, a spark would begin to smolder. As the wind picked up, it would devour nearby leaves and brush, then begin hopping from tree to tree. A few hours later, shortly after midnight, Carla was the first to realize something was wrong. She and her family were sitting by the campfire, drinking beer and listening to music. When she and her cousin got up to pee, they noticed a glow on the horizon.
It wasn't a big fire that we saw, but you could see the red-orange spark.
Kind of like a campfire, but high up on a hillside. They decided to call 911.
911.
We're at Wagner's Campground, and it looks like there's a fire south by where the lake is.
At that point, the Creek Fire was only 6 hours old, just a few hundred acres in size and more than 10 miles away. So it's no surprise the Madera County employee who answered didn't seem to know what they were talking about.
Are you seeing a campfire or are you seeing a forest fire?
It looks like an actual forest fire.
Where was it? To the north, the south, before the lake, or beyond it? Eventually, the dispatcher got all he needed and the call ended. So Carla and her cousin went to sleep, shaken, but relatively reassured that the fire wasn't coming for them that weekend. There were hundreds of people camping here over Labor Day. Carla and her family didn't know the off-roading club, but their paths would cross countless times during the chaos that would unfold by just the following afternoon.
By 12, that's when everything happened. That's when everything happened.
By the time everyone woke up on Saturday, there had been a shift.
So when I woke up, I did notice it was kind of cloudy.
The sun was kind of like orange color.
The sky was orange and there was ash, like big pieces of asphalt.
They had misgivings. Carla asked about the fire at the general store, but the cashier said it was too far to be a threat. The fishermen at the lake said the same thing when Rolando rode to the dam to scope it out. And Alex, at breakfast, she made a prophetic joke.
And I said, like, the most regrettable thing I think I'll ever say in my whole life.
It was her 31st birthday, and she blames the mimosas.
I said, if there's anything here that you think is important, you better take pictures of it for insurance before you go on this hike. Looking back at it, I can't believe that came out of my mouth.
I'm no fire specialist, but I'm pretty sure that Alex didn't cause the creek fire. Nonetheless, without any warnings from the Forest Service, from the Sheriff's Office, or the camp caretakers, everyone shrugged the smoke off. Around noon, Alex, Raul, and Rolando took off on a hike with a few others. It would take around 2 hours and end at the lake, where the rest of their group would be waiting with grills, beer, and jet skis, ready to party for the rest of the day. But around an hour in, it was clear something was amiss. As the terrain opened up around them, they began to see spot fires on distant hillsides.
And embers coming out of the sky now.
Nothing very alarming. They looked, you know, about 2-3 miles away.
Then the fires got bigger and closer.
So you're actually seeing flames, not just the smoke?
No, flames, yeah.
By the time they reached the lake, there was no party. Most of their friends were gone, only a few trucks left at the boat launch. They were the last hikers to finish, and the leader of their off-roading group was waiting for them on a jet ski. He said there was no time to walk back to the boat launch.
On a little two-seater jet ski. He's like, come on, guys, we gotta go, we gotta go. And I was like, with the dog? Because I have my six-month-old puppy. He's like, we gotta go now.
They and their puppy rode back to the boat launch, then hopped in a friend's truck. As they drove the windy 10 minutes back to the campsite, the patches of fire began closing in. Across the lake, a chilling sight.
There's people camping, I guess, all through here. So now we're seeing them like
tearing around the lake.
Yeah, and the trailer and all going probably, I don't know, 50, 60, I don't know. They were almost like they're escaping the fire themselves.
Those folks probably made it home, but Alex and Raul were too late. Within minutes, they and the others would find out that they were stranded with only one way to go. Around this time, the Creek Fire was already creating its own weather system. Enormous plumes of smoke, known as pyrocumulonimbus formations, that looked like volcanic eruptions. They shot so high into the atmosphere that airplane passengers were snapping stunning photos of them over the wings. But back at the campground, Carla didn't have the wide-open perspective from the lake or from thousands of feet in the air. Her family had spent late morning and part of the afternoon at the creek, just a few hundred feet from their tents.
We were just chilling, you know, just sitting in the river, talking and enjoying and drinking.
It was just after lunch when Carla made the short walk back to her tent and finally noticed the hillside.
Walking back to where we were sitting, I remember looking to my left and I looked up and Carrie, the fire was on the mountain top. You could see the fire. You could see the flame.
She ran back and grabbed her aunts and uncles, everyone who was still at the creek.
And then by the time we got up from the water and like we headed to the campground, one of the people that worked for the Wagner store, she looked frantic. And she was just saying, we gotta go. She's like, this is not a drill. She goes like, everybody evacuate. And then me, being me, I stopped her and I said, hey, I said, how long do we have to pack? And she kind of looked at me like, oh, you're dumb, you know, like, why are you asking me that?
But Carla was hesitating because she couldn't find her sister or her brother or a few of their cousins. They'd gone for a hike that morning, but they should have been there with a few others who'd gotten back earlier. Carla stopped one of her cousins to ask.
So I told her, I said, where's everybody? You know, like, we gotta go. And she's like, they weren't with us. She goes like, they went to the waterfall.
The waterfall. That means they went on a second, longer hike further from the campground.
And I was like, oh my God.
Elsewhere in the camp, panic had set in. Vicky, Rolando, and their kids had already packed up, but they had to wait just to pull out of their sight.
Because of how backed up it was, people trying to go in, trying to leave, and it was just like a shit show.
Alex and Raul were still on the road back from the lake. So many cars were leaving, the truck they were in couldn't get back into the campground.
Everyone's screaming at her like, go, go, go. Cars are honking behind it, but she can't go because literally they will not stop pulling out.
So began a frantic exodus out of the mountains. The lucky ones beat the fire along the winding highway back to North Fork or Fresno or Madera. But for hundreds of others, including these three families, that route was impossible, blocked by flames and fallen trees. Desperate for a way out and for hope, 911 calls would start pouring in. And eventually, dispatchers would give everyone the same advice. Get to the lake. And if it got bad enough, get in the water. In the next episode, the gut-wrenching decisions these families had to make about what and who to bring to the lake.
Once we're in the car and we're going, I just let it all go. I started screaming, crying.
When I saw the fire, four cars behind us, I told the kids, get ready to run.
We were just like, we gotta go, we gotta go, we gotta go. You know, get in the car, you know?
That's coming up next week on Escape from Mammoth Pool.
Subscribe to Escape from Mammoth Pool wherever you get your podcast. And you can find photos and more at kvpr.org. New episodes will be released on Fridays. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Next spring, construction is expected to start on the Dolores Huerta Peace and Justice Cultural Center in Bakersfield. In addition to being home to the Dolores Huerta Foundation, the 36,000 square foot complex will also include an amphitheater, child development center, art gallery, and community organizing training academy. I spoke to the civil rights icon about her vision for the center that will bear her name. She started the conversation by discussing how the project was conceived.
We outgrew our office because we are now up to about 45 full-time staff. And of course, with the pandemic, everybody's been working from home. And so we outgrew our building. We had offices on three different floors in our building. And so we started looking for a bigger space. And my son, Emilio Huerta, who had worked with the Cesar Chavez Foundation and doing their housing program, said, what we need to do is just build our own building. We went and we looked at several buildings so that we could move into a larger space, and none of them were adequate. And he said, look, he said, the best thing to do is to just build your own building. And that way you have your own building, you don't have to be paying rent. And so that's where the idea was born. And then of course, the work that we're doing, we have a big youth program. We're going into the early childhood development. And so we wanted some space to be able to do that also. And then also our partners are a credit union, the Self-Help Credit Union, which has offices throughout the state of California. And they're actually out of North Carolina originally. And they do a lot of progressive politics, going against the payday loans. And they've been our partners for many, many years. And it turned out that they had a site that was way too big for their credit union. And they wanted to sell the site, but they wanted to do it to some progressive organizations. And it turned out that my son was the chair of that credit union. And I guess in some discussions that they were having about how they wanted to, they have this huge city block and they wanted to be able to, sell that block to some organization. And so the idea was born, okay, well, why don't we just use it to build a center? And so a big part of the center will be not only to have meeting rooms for nonprofit organizations, to have a place where people can have their parties, community meetings, weddings, quinceañeras, but then also the root of what we do is organizing. And part of it will be an organizing academy to teach people democracy 101, civic engagement.
And in keeping with the intersectional approach that your advocacy work has always taken, I understand the center is going to focus on a lot more than just Latinx culture and history. Is that right?
Oh, of course. One of the things that we want to do is make sure that all of the different groups of people who contributed to making this San Joaquin Valley, the Central Valley, such a rich agricultural area are honored. And so that means if we start with Native people, the Indigenous people who were the first farmers here in this area, the people that came, were brought here as slaves that worked in these cotton fields and in these vegetable fields, in the food fields here in the Central Valley. Of course, the Latinos who from Mexico, Central America that continue to come in here to work the fields. And then the Okies also. And there were a lot of Asians, the Filipinos, the Koreans, the Japanese, Chinese, Cambodians, and Vietnamese that have all contributed to the richness of agriculture here. So we want to make sure that all of those ethnic groups are honored and because we do a lot of work in education also, by the way, We're active in 20 different school districts here in the Central Valley and expanding. Wherever we form a chapter, then we get into the local school districts there to start making sure that, you know, now we're going to have ethnic studies and so that we can make sure that all of the histories of all of these people that contributed will be included in the curriculums that are taught in those schools.
So this is more of a conceptual question, but the words peace and justice are right there in the name of the Cultural Center. What do peace and justice look like to you for the people of the Central Valley? What is that vision that you hold, and how does the center fit into that vision?
Well, when we talk about peace, that of course means that we advocate and we teach nonviolence. The way that Gandhi taught it, the way that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. practiced it. We'll have people like Reverend Jim Lawson, who was a person that worked with Dr. Martin Luther King to teach nonviolence to the young people that were there in the civil rights movement in the South. We would want him to come as to be one of our teachers here. And then, of course, in the farm worker movement with Cesar Chavez and myself, we always practiced nonviolence in the work that we did. When we talk about the justice, then we kind of combine the two, because a lot of our work that we do is about police misconduct, about not having so many so-called security officers on the school campuses. In fact, one of our goals is to get all of these security policemen off of our school campuses, because we know that that actually creates more violence than what it causes. In the justice work, we, of course, do a lot of work in civic engagement, because that's where it starts, you know, getting people to understand the political process, to get them engaged in registering people to vote, and then advocating for progressive legislation in Sacramento and in the Congress. It's more than being just a policy institute, a policy organization, but it's actually engaging people at the grassroots level that we do through our organizing. And so part of the organizing that work that we do is we organize people and then get them to volunteer to make the improvements that they work that they want in their community. And in doing so, they learn the process, and also getting themselves elected to different positions like school boards or water boards. You know, it's this is why I like to call it democracy in action, or democracy 101. To give some examples, we filed a lawsuit against the Kern High School District because they expelled 2,100 students in 1 year. Needless to say, that 95% of the students that they expelled were students that were Black and Brown students. We won that lawsuit, and they have to start doing positive behavior intervention, education to their teachers. They have to change a lot of the practices that they were doing that are discriminatory against Black and Brown students. So, and in fact, we just barely signed the final settlement last week. So the teachers have to take the training on these systems so that they don't continue to discriminate against students of color.
So I'm so glad you brought up that lawsuit. You know, certainly the Central Valley and Kern County have a history of racial tension. Can you speak about the significance of the location of the center in Bakersfield?
Well, I think it's very apropos that we are based here, because we can become like the microcosm, because of so many of the issues that we face here in Kern County. Kevin McCarthy, the Republican leader of the Congress, that this is his district. And so when you see the work that we have to do here, that is the type of, you might say it's going to be a model for the work that needs to be done in the South, in the Southwest, in the United States of America.
So of course it takes a lot of money and a lot of capital to build a community center of this scope, but you recently received a pretty big boost from the state. $15 million was secured from the state budget. What does that investment mean for the center's future?
Well, it certainly puts us on the ground. So, you know, we already have an architecture. We already have the plans that have been drawn from previous funding that we got, part of it from the California Endowment. And then we got another $300,000 matching grant. But this really makes it possible for us to go forward and to secure the property financially. you know, continue to pay the architects and you know, the people that are doing the planning. We still have another probably $7 million that we have to raise, but this definitely puts us on the path so that we can raise that money.
And when do you hope that it's going to open?
Well, they're hoping to break ground at the first part, and maybe in the spring of 2022, to break ground then and start the building. Oh, you know, the one thing that takes a lot of time is getting the permits, right? So depending on how long it takes the city to approve our permits, then we can start the building process. And by the way, we're getting a lot of support from the Building Trades Union and the other labor unions, and they're helping us not only in being supportive of the process, but also in helping us raise the funds that we need.
Well, speaking of unions, if you may, I'd like to switch gears and ask you about a piece of legislation, AB 616, that would give farm workers in California more options to vote in union elections. This bill was recently advanced from the state Senate to the Assembly. It was sponsored by the United Farm Workers. Can you talk about why the United Farm Workers believes this legislation is so necessary?
Well, the current process of workers voting for the union, they usually do the voting on the site of the employers. And you have employer observers and union observers when they are doing the voting. Well, that puts a lot of pressure on the workers. Okay, when you have the bosses, you know, looking at you and staring at you, or the boss's representatives, while you're trying to cast your vote, it makes it very uneasy for the workers. With this legislation that the UFW is trying to pass, the workers can—it's almost like a mail-in ballot. You know, there can be a drop-off place where they can drop their ballot. You don't have to have a union observer there, you know, staring at you while you're voting. So it will make it a lot less pressure on the workers, make it easier for them to vote, just like mail-in ballots are making it easier for us to vote.
And how optimistic are you that the bill will become a law?
I think it will. I mean, I think that Governor Newsom is supportive of the Farm Workers Union. I think the other legislators are also supportive. I mean, there's no reason why anybody should object to this. It's pretty much making the voting process easier. And this is what we do in California, you know. Way back in 1963, I lobbied the law then with an organization called the Community Service Organization, which preceded the United Farm Workers. I lobbied a law through the Sacramento legislature that you didn't have to have a deputy registrar to register you to vote. By the way, this is a process that they have in Texas, that if you were a U.S. citizen, you could, over 18 years old, I guess then it was 21, that you could register another person to vote, that you'd have to go out there and find a deputy registrar. You didn't have to have people that raised their hand and were deputized and had to swear, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I passed that law in 1963. And we know what a difference that has made, especially for low-income people and people of color to register to vote. So this one, I think, and I compare that with what the United Farm Workers is trying to do to make it easier for farm workers to vote for the representative.
So right now, farm workers are facing so many threats to their health, between dangerous heat and wildfire smoke, and of course, the ongoing pandemic. Can you just speak to the current conditions?
Well, farm workers are going through a lot. And again, because of the heat, of the way they have to work, you know, they have to live, but they also know that they have to feed the nation, right? So they are very responsible about continuing to work, because they, you know, farm workers are really proud of their occupation. A lot of people look down on farm workers, but they don't realize that farm workers really have a lot of pride in the work that they do, because they themselves know how important they are to the nation, even if the nation does not respect or recognize what they do to feed everyone. And there has been a lot of, thank goodness, a lot of mentions of farm workers recently, but that doesn't really extend to, you know, giving farm worker families the resources that they need, you know, in order for them to be able to live a better life in their communities. We look at the farm worker communities around the state. You go to places like Wheat Patch, where the Grapes of Wrath was filmed. And it pretty much looks like it did when the Grapes of Wrath was filmed way back in the 30s and the 40s, right? And you go to places like Kettleman City and you say, what? There's no sidewalks here. I mean, it's the farm worker conditions are still very bad. So every day we sit down, we eat the food the farm workers pick, and we never think about you know, what are farm worker families going through? We look at the educational system that our foundation is working very hard on. The farm worker children are not getting an equitable education. As I just mentioned, the lawsuit that we filed against the Kern High School District. So we like to romanticize farm workers, but we really don't do what we need to do to get them the support that they need.
What are some concrete steps that people can take to show their solidarity and their support of farm workers?
Well, one of the things, of course, is to support the farm worker bill that you mentioned, to make sure that it passes, to contact your state legislator and ask them to vote for it. And there's another important bill right now in the Congress that will give farm workers the legal status in the United States of America to give them a green card. And I would say it's supporting the people of communities of color in any way that you can, especially, let me give you one example. We just had a Proposition 15 that we were all working on to bring in more money into our educational system in the United States. It failed. It failed by not very much, I think by 5% or something in the state, but that bill, had it passed, would have brought in, I think, I'm trying to remember the number, but maybe $9 billion or more into our educational system. And the state of California, you know, they give extra money to all of the school districts for low-income students, for English learners, and for foster children. So I think it's important for people to also look at their local school district to make sure that that money that is that extra funding that is supposed to be going towards English learners and low-income students and foster kids, to make sure that money is actually appropriated the way that it should be appropriated, because oftentimes the school districts don't do that. And that's why we have to be active in all these different school districts to make sure that that money is spent the way that it's supposed to be spent. I guess getting engaged, I think, is and that, of course, not only helps farm workers, but it helps all of the politics that we are fighting for in our state. I should say progressive politics that we are fighting for.
Your foundation, you as an activist, have always worked on so many fronts to address injustice in our communities. And I'm wondering how you managed to do this work without it overwhelming you, and particularly in light of this moment that we're living through. Just in the last, you know, couple of weeks, the news has been so overwhelming between the situation in Afghanistan and raging wildfires and the fight for voting rights and hurricanes and hospitals overflowing with COVID patients. I mean, it's all so much. How do you stay grounded and centered in moments of this volatility?
Well, the reason that we can work on so many fronts, because we are a multi-issue organization. You know, we have a youth group. We're working right now on the lines, you know, on the redistricting. We have a team working on that. We have a team working on getting out the vote for the election on September the 15th, both a C3 and a C4 group, the nonprofit and the one that we can actually endorse and work for, Gavin Newsom. We're doing food banks. We're doing vaccine clinics every weekend. We're doing door-to-door canvassing to get people to sign up for their vaccine shots. And the only way we can do all of this work is the way that we organize. And we organize at the grassroots level. We organize people so that they can volunteer to do the work. And so this means that we can have volunteers that are doing a lot of the work that needs to be done. I'll give you an example. About a month and a half ago, we did 10 food banks in one day. And we had over 300 volunteers that helped us distribute the food. And we did this in four different areas, Antelope Valley, Kern, Tulare, and Fresno counties, you know. And so the way that we can do so many different things is that we have organized a lot of volunteers to do the work, you know, otherwise we couldn't do it. It's not staff driven, it's volunteer driven.
How is your vaccine outreach work going?
It's gone pretty well. The one thing that we have found is that you have to make the vaccines accessible to the people, you know. A lot of times they were having the vaccine clinics at hours when people were actually maybe had to go to work. And as we know, the farm workers have had to continue working throughout the pandemic. So if you can, we would try to make the appointments for them at times that they could actually go get the vaccines at times that were available to them, not to the clinics, but available to the people that needed it. And by the way, we're continuing that program because we know that here in the Central Valley, our numbers are still very, very high of people that have been affected by COVID.
I would love to hear your general thoughts about living through this pandemic, this last year and a half. What has this time taught you, and what lessons are you taking away as a result of it?
Well, we knew ahead of time, I mean, we knew when the pandemic broke out that the one area where our communities were, you might say, were affected because we did not have the broadband. You know, you had families that didn't have computers. Many of the people that we organize are not computer savvy. And so we've actually had to get computers and distribute them to some of our volunteers and teach them just how to do the basics so we could continue to have our meetings with them. So that is one of the main things. And we knew that ahead of time, and we knew that when that pandemic broke out, and we had to do all of our meetings by Zoom, but people didn't know how to get on the Zooms, you know, so we had to teach them how to get on the Zooms and actually buy computers for some of our leaders so that we could have Zoom meetings with them and so that they could help us with the work. I forgot to mention, we did a lot of work on the census. And a lot of that we did on telephones and getting our people to do the phone banking to make sure that people would register for the census. So it's made our work very, very difficult, especially because we are an organization that organizes through house meetings, et cetera. So a lot of that organizing, now we've had to do it through the telephone or and as much as we can through the internet and social media.
Well, Dolores Huerta, thank you so much for all that you do for the community. It is always an honor to talk with you, and congratulations on the upcoming Peace and Justice Cultural Center in Bakersfield.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for the interview.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Last week, we heard about the return of live music to local venues. This week, we examine the return of live in-person music instruction to schools. KVPR's David Ouse spoke with some Valley music educators to hear what it's been like for them and their students.
That's a group of singers at Fresno City College doing something they love more than anything else, making music together in person, something they haven't been able to do for a year and a half. Schools are now back in session and in person, though with the resurgence of COVID cases, things are still tentative. I asked Julie Dana, director of voice and choral music at Fresno City College, what it's like to be back.
Joy. Total and complete joy. It is amazing. It is amazing. Today when we left class and the brass group was out front running through something, and one of the singers looked at me and went, "I love hearing live music again." And then she headed down the hallway to her car. It's joy beyond belief. It's almost overwhelming. And then I was terrified on the first day of school. I really was terrified. Because you're like all the stuff and the COVID and to the kids and how they need to be and stuff. And then they start singing and you just go, "All right, let's go." It's 10 seconds of sheer terror. And then it completely veers the next way and it's just complete joy.
Tell me a little bit about the protocols that you're using to stay safe, and then specifically how you're making sure you're staying safe with the extra risky behavior of vocalization in a group together.
At City, I'm really grateful because the admin decided we were going to roll in gradually. So about 35% of the campus is on campus now. And they had asked us a while back, if then do you want to? And of course, my answer was yes. And most of the performing ensemble directors were yes, we want to be back. But with that comes, okay, so what do you want us to do? Well, you need to wear masks. And for me, a director of singers, and all you have to say is we're a choir, and everybody goes, "Oh, choir in Washington, February 2020. The whole choir got sick and people died." And, you know, that we became the poster children for COVID-19 spreading events as the choir. So for me and many of my colleagues, it was really super important for us to watch the science, but specifically the science that was dealing with us, you know, with music. And so studies in Boulder and on the East Coast did a number of studies, and there were webinars with the National Association of Teachers of Singing. And so, you know, I started attending all those things because I wanted to see what was specific to our area, and super grateful to our admin because they would say, okay, you need to tell us how you're going to come back. So they allowed us to say, well, we need this and this and this. So we have singers' masks that we wear the entire time, inside, outside. I don't care where we are. They're masked, and they're great because they don't lie on their face, but it's a challenge getting used to breathing in there. I feel like, wow, am I really this out of shape as I'm going through rehearsal? But the kids are 6 feet apart. And right now, within an hour, we break for 10 minutes and just leave the room. We just leave. So even though they're singing in masks, they're separated, I still want that air, you know, the air exchange to happen. And at City, they went through and tested all the air handlers and all that stuff. They turned them up. Our building was, we were fortunate because ours was one of the newer ones. So they just, you know, cranked it. And I think it has like 8 air exchanges per hour, something like that, 8 to 10. And so if we leave for 10 minutes, the air is going to be clean. And so we just go outside, and it's a nice break for us because, you know, getting back into the swing of things is, we love it. We love it. And you don't want to stop.
During the past year and a half, music directors and their ensembles have learned all kinds of ways to make music remotely in isolation. Paul Lucchese at Fresno City College shares about that experience.
Music teachers were scrambling, trying to figure out what to do. It's like, okay, well, we need to just do a virtual ensemble. I had no idea how to do that. And a lot of people had no idea how to do that. And we just dove into it. I was fortunate enough to direct the first California junior high all-state jazz band completely virtually. And so that was a really unique experience because I had never heard the kids play like together ever. And so that's not anything I've ever learned about in my life. And so that part was something that I missed every single day. And there's no way to replicate that. And a virtual ensemble, I mean, that's a great thing and they're fun to listen to and they're fun to watch, but it's not, you're not playing together with musicians at the same time. So I guess there are a number of things that worked really well and gave students accessibility. It didn't really give our musicians accessibility to each other. And we adapted, but one of my students at the beginning of this semester said he didn't realize how much he had taken for granted being able to be with musicians. So the musicians I have now are just people who are hungry to be together. They're just hungry to play music together. Like every musician that I know that enjoys playing is just like, and just reading music. You can't really do that with a group of people in virtually. And so we've been doing that these first couple of weeks, and you know, a student that did an incredible job for me as a virtual musician, he came up to me yesterday and I said, wasn't that just so much better? He goes, oh my gosh, it's a million times better. Because it's all instant. And that's the thing, that technology is about speed, but it actually ended up delaying everything.
Returning to in-person instruction and rehearsals is clearly something students and teachers have been craving, but musicians also want to perform. I asked Dr. Matt Darling, chair of the music department at Fresno State, about their plans for concerts this fall.
Most of our ensembles are planning to have live performances, and we are going to be open to the general public. People can visit our website for that schedule. So all of the patrons will need to do online COVID screening before entering the halls, and we're also going to have them have their temperatures checked. We are not restricting the numbers of patrons right now, but we're mindful that things may change, and we'll, of course, adhere to county guidelines and protocols. So that's kind of where we're at with our live performances. In fact, we have a big thing coming up with the Boston Brass on September 9. So, yeah.
How's it been having students back in?
It's been great. It's been awesome, right? I mean, we love that interaction with the students. And it's so much better to see people in person. Body language is extremely important from my perspective and our perspective. And it's, I mean, it is still a challenge to not see full facial expressions because of the masks, but it's still better than Zoom. So, and some faculty have, you know, really kind of teared up seeing the students come back. I got emotional a little bit the other day when I got to see all my percussionists in the concert hall. It was really cool. So just having that personal interaction, it just doesn't work virtually. So we will do everything we can to keep our students safe. But I really feel like we're doing a good job with that so far. It's been really good.
Here's Dr. Carrie Earnhardt, Director of Choral Activities at Fresno State.
On Wednesday, we had our first rehearsal with concert choir. And we started out with the alma mater, just something simple and something that they all need to know. And it was, I mean, you just felt like that warmth come over your chest in such an overwhelming way. I thought my heart might just leap right out of it. It was just so awesome to have all of my kids back together.
Here's Alicia Wells, director and instructor at Fresno City College.
I have been immensely fulfilled coming back. Not seeing the students for over a year was really trying for me as an educator and as an individual, as a human being. And I think of the word ensemble, which translates to mean together. And just being in the room makes so much of a difference.
Just a few perspectives from area educators on the return of live music in schools. Music persists, as do musicians. As a reminder of that, here's a recording made during the pandemic by Fresno State Jazz Band A, led by Jazz Studies Director Richard Giddens from their forthcoming album. For Valley Edition, I'm David Alves.
And finally, in celebration of the holiday weekend, let's talk about something everyone loves, eating. We're going to Goshen. It's just off Highway 99, halfway between Fresno and Bakersfield, mostly known for its ethanol plant. But among the warehouses and ag supply stores, there's a jewel of a joint whose popularity goes well beyond this tiny community. Originally reported for the California Report magazine, KVPR's Alice Daniel takes us to Lady Chicken and Rice.
The food truck sits in the parking lot of a supply store that sells plastic dinosaurs, stuffed animals, and novelty items for vending machines. Lady Chicken and Rice is hand-painted in red letters on the front of the truck. Lady Chicken is named for the woman who created the deep-fried Lao chicken recipe that's so popular here.
I call her Lady. She's my lady.
That's Boon Tong Sang talking about his wife, Boon Luck. He didn't give her the nickname, though. Fame did. Well, fame among the locals here in Goshen.
They don't know her name. They call, oh, that's Lady Chicken. That Lady Chicken. After we make business.
A business that serves as many as 500 customers a day. Lines form by 10 a.m.
Thank you very much.
Have a nice day.
All right, thank you. Have a good day.
Boon Tong says he's met travelers from as far away as Virginia and Texas who find rave reviews on Yelp or other food apps. But there are also plenty of regulars who greet him. They know him as Jimmy.
Later, Jimmy. Thank you.
Like Tony Solis, a UPS driver who's waving while picking up a bag of egg rolls in one hand and an iced coffee in the other. He says he comes here at least once a week.
Great food, good price, friendly people. Awesome.
The friendly people include Boon Tong's employees, whom he calls family, even though they're from Mexico and he's from Laos. Ramona Villa says they stay busy all day until 5 p.m.
We never stop cooking until it's time to go home.
She's inside the truck prepping the $3 plates of golden brown chicken and sticky rice. She's got a large, colorful tattoo just below her neck that says Robert.
My husband.
Robert, Lady Chicken. Love is written all around here. Ramona has filled little plastic containers of homemade green jalapeno sauce and is dumping them into a bin so they can easily be sent out to customers. Speaking of love, people return just for the sauce, she says.
Everybody always comes back over and over, and that's the first thing they always say is the chili.
Marbella Sotelo takes orders at the truck.
Un pollo con arroz, unos spring rolls, y gracias.
The marinated chicken is twice fried, the second time at a higher temperature to make it extra crispy, Marbella says.
I think it's the flavor, you know. They got something, the chicken, they, you know, it's a good flavor. And the way that he cooked is, you know, crispy and, you know, soft inside, so it's really good.
Fresh spring rolls are also on the menu, egg rolls too. That's why Arandira Aranzazu comes here.
More often than I should. Very, very good food. You can taste the authenticity of it. And my favorite are the egg rolls. Egg rolls by far are the best in town, for sure. Hands down.
Two chicken and rice. Two legs and four sauces.
Two extra chicken?
Yes.
Can I have two legs, please?
A few other customers in line share why they're here.
It's close by. The food is good. And the ladies are friendly.
Quality, I guess you could say. Because I've tried a lot of chicken and rice, and it's not the same.
The authenticity of it, it's not like anything else. Can't really get this anywhere else other than in here.
Boon Tong knows he's got a good thing going here. Regulars he greets daily, people who come from far away to enjoy the food, employees he views as family, and a popular chicken recipe created by the woman he loves.
Maybe I say, hey, lady, you know, I love you. Something like that every day. We have to.
I'm Alice Daniel in Goshen.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Madi Bolaños, and Sarith Hawk. Technical support is from Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, working to build a more effective, compassionate, and just healthcare system. On the web at chcf.org/health-equity.